It's the half moon, lunar observance day, the waning moon, December 23rd, 2024. Thought I would talk a little bit about renunciation and also giving a reminder that this life is very fleeting. It was 20 years ago. In a couple days, it'll be 20 years ago that there was this tsunami in Thailand. Oh, it hit Indonesia and Thailand and other places as well. And a very large number of people died suddenly. And it was a very huge disaster and still worthy of recollecting and being mindful of. And we don't know when something like that might happen again. And so it's really an illustration of the fleeting nature of human existence, of all existence, of all life. And as I was just in Bhutan recently for a couple of weeks, and Padmasambhava, also known as Guru Rinpoche, is a very central figure there. And he's always depicted with a staff. And a big hallmark of his teachings was a constant reminder of impermanence and death. And so this staff has somewhat, it's a bit strange looking. It's got three heads impaled on it. One is a head with wrinkly skin. One is a head with red skin. And one is a head without skin, a skull. So that's aging, sickness, and death. Constant reminder of aging, sickness, and death. And it is good to always remind ourselves of that. And when that is apparent for us, then we will have the result we want anyways, is to have an impetus to practice reflecting on the fleeting nature of human life. Then that's supposed to give us some sort of impetus or inspiration to practice in response to that. But if we just become depressed and melancholy, that's not the response we're looking for. The response we're looking for is a sense of urgency, because we don't know when death will come. So we develop a sense of urgency. When we have that sense of urgency, we'll feel like, what can we do? We can practice. And this is illustrated also in the life story of the Bodhisattva, Siddhartha Gautama, before he became the Buddha, then actually coming into contact with an old person, a sick person, a dead person. So these are the first three heavenly messengers, aging, sickness, and death. And then the fourth heavenly messenger being the robes, the robe wearer, the one who is seeking a way out. So that is very symbolic. The Buddha seeing a samana, a religious wanderer, and that's the response. That's the response to those first three heavenly messengers. And so that points to renunciation. And this is Nekama Barami. So Nekama, it's an acknowledgement that things that are impermanent can't give us any sense of lasting fulfillment or lasting satisfaction, and that any fulfillment and satisfaction we get is itself an impermanent phenomenon. So whatever arises and passes away, and if we seek things that are impermanent, then any well-being we get from that is not going to last. So to seek something different, to seek something apart from that. And the way in the Thai version of the Buddha Prawat, the Buddha's biography, it's really interesting when some of the thought processes he's said to have gone through upon deciding to leave the home life and take up the life of a wandering ascetic. Then one of the thought processes was, we normally think in terms of opposites, like, okay, birth is the opposite of death, big is the opposite of small, tall is the opposite of short, and so on. Good is the opposite of bad. But the Bodhisattva, the Buddha-to-be, didn't think like that. He didn't think in terms of that type of a duality. He thought of it in terms of what I call meta-duality, M-E-T-A, meta-duality, or not non-duality. Non-duality is, I think, just another idea that can tie our mind up in knots. But this kind of meta-duality, which is the Bodhisattva in the Thai biography, is said to have reflected thus, there is birth and death, so there must be the opposite of birth and death. So he took birth and death as one side of a duality rather than a duality in and of itself. So there is birth and death, so there must be that which is beyond birth and death. There is birth and death, so there must be the opposite of birth and death. There must be the deathless. That's how his mind worked. And that's what caused him to think that, okay, how can I discover this? How can I seek this? And what is the nature of the deathless? And how can I practice in a way so as to realize the deathless? So his mind worked like that, and that helped him to go through that process of deciding to go forth from the home life into homelessness. And the sense of renunciation for him, because his parami was full, the Nekama parami, every parami for him was completely full, all 10 paramis, dana, sila, kanti, and so on, patient, satya, truth, metta, upeka, loving kindness, and equanimity, and so on. All these paramis were full, including the Nekama parami, the renunciation parami. So because renunciation parami was full, then upon making, and the satya parami was full, those two work together, then upon making that decision to leave the home life, there's no return ticket, there's no plan B, then that's it. Either I will find the deathless, is how his mind was working, either I will find the deathless, or I'll die trying. And that was the courageous aspiration, the courageous renunciation of the bodhisattva going forth from the home life into homelessness. So that's the Nekama, the renunciation. And when I would read about this, and many, many great practitioners, great masters of the past have had similar aspirations. And when I would read about this, I'd be so inspired. And then I would read these kind of things as a layman thinking about coming to the monastery. I remember I would talk about these kind of things with other people, and even read some of these types of teachings about renunciation to other people, and they wouldn't have the same reaction I had. So I felt incredibly inspired and wanting to do that myself, and a sense of awe and wonder at the Buddha and the great masters of the past. And then the reaction of other people would be kind of like, what are you talking about? Like, that's kind of, that doesn't make much sense. But it made sense to me at the time, and it still makes even more sense now. And why is that? Why is this? Is that our karma? Is that our past life karma? Why is that? Why do we feel inspired by such things? There's some sort of, you know, I was the reaction of other people that I was getting is, well, that's just some sort of childish fantasy. Come back to the real world. Come back. That's not the real world. But as time goes on, and the more I practice, and I interact with, you know, quote unquote, the real world a lot, traveling and so on, being outside of the monastery, and I'm more and more convinced that this is the real world. That's the false world. This is the real world. The deathless, however we want to describe it, that is the real. And that's in the suttas as well. We find that it's that Nibbana is the true reality. And all the impermanent phenomena that we experience, that's the mirage. That's the illusion. That's the rainbow-like world of experience that's just arising and passing away like a dream. And that Nibbana's the reality. The deathless is the reality. Or we could say the Buddha is the reality, the awareness that's never apart from us, that we can't not have it, no matter what realm of existence we're in, no matter what we're experiencing, no matter what thought proliferation we're lost in, awareness is experiencing it. Awareness is there all the time. Even any lack of mindfulness we experience, awareness is there. Awareness is experiencing that lack of mindfulness. Awareness is experiencing the results of clinging or not clinging. It's just always there. But we need to look at it. We need to realize it. Or else the awareness itself doesn't get caught in suffering, but there is suffering. There is suffering. There is suffering and dissatisfaction. So this sense of nekama or renunciation, it's an acknowledgement of the unsatisfactory nature of what we're currently caught up in. And it's a sense of going forth and seeking another way. So we were talking a little bit about, speaking of Bhutan, was very happy to be reminded of the great Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, a great master, a great practitioner who passed away in, I believe, 1991. And once he left Tibet, he was invited to live in Bhutan, and he actually had a residence in Bhutan, so they have a museum now there, and we were able to go visit there. And the feeling of going there is very powerful for me, as a definite pilgrimage location, going to this great master, that the residence of a former great master who was very inspired by. And when, you know, at the age of 13, he was ready to leave home and go and be a yogi up in the Himalayas and devote his entire life to meditation. And so, you know, sometimes I would compare myself to these great masters and think, well, God, you know, maybe a few more lifetimes before when I was 13, I was a big mess. It's not ready to do something like that. Like being drunk in a dream, not just the dream, like illusion of reality, but being drunk within the dream. So it's just a utter lack of direction and total confusion, total bewilderment. I think so many of us go through that. But then Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, who I believe is a great bodhisattva, Buddha to be, perhaps some point in the future, then with some immense barami already, you know, being ready to leave home at the age of 13. And so that, because he's someone who lived in recent history, as the Buddha was over 2,500 years ago, so we have these examples. And because I was talking about him at tea time a little bit, I thought it might be nice to, I actually looked up this poem he wrote when he was 13, and a letter that he left for his parents when he was leaving home. I thought I would read that as part of this talk. So it's not that long. It's he says, "My dearest parents, you gave me birth with all the freedoms and advantages of human life, and you have cared for me with love from my infancy till now. Since you introduced me to an authentic teacher, it is thanks to your kindness that I have encountered the path of liberation. After hearing, thinking about, and meditating on the life of my perfect teacher, I have resolved to slip quietly away from all this life's concerns and roam through empty, uninhabited valleys. Father and mother, stay in your handsome, lofty house. I, your young son, long instead for empty caves. Thank you for the fine, soft clothes you gave me, yet I don't need them. I would rather dress in plain white felt. I leave my valuable belongings behind. A begging bowl, a staff, and Dharma robes are all I need. I've cast aside this luxury and wealth with no regrets. A handbook of profound advice is all I wish to collect. I leave this garden full of splendid flowers and head for the wilderness of overhanging cliffs alone. I need no attendants who just fuel anger and attachment. Birds and wild animals are the only company I long for. Earlier, in the presence of my sovereign teacher, as he bestowed the secret heart essence empowerment, I vowed to abandon all the activities of this life and practice in accordance with the Dhamma. In my heart, that promise is as clear as if engraved in stone. I cannot but leave for a secluded mountain retreat. Although for now your son will hide away in mountain glens, your smiling faces will be with me always, nor shall I forget your loving care, and if I reach the citadel of experience and realization, I shall repay your kindness, of that you can be sure." Written by Khyentse Rinpoche when he was 13 years old. So, yeah, for me, things like that really illustrate true renunciation. So it's, you know, if we look at that poem, he's very clear, very measured. Actually, for any of you who look into his life story, he actually did want to, all he wanted to do was become a monk at first, but then he ended up actually becoming a yogi. And I believe one of his later teachers said he shouldn't ordain. That wasn't his path in this particular life, but for sure the renunciation was there. So this is a type of heart renunciation that we're talking about. It doesn't have anything to do with necessarily our external appearance, but it's about being unencumbered and free of concerns, free of worries. Longpa Liem is another one who really seems to embody that sense of total renunciation. So no worries, no concerns, totally unencumbered, totally free. These traditions are all the same. They all stem from the Buddha. So that sense of anybody who wants to really take the get inspired to take the path to the farthest point possible, then that sense of renunciation is going to be necessary. But then the doubt can come up. Yeah, perhaps this is just a fanciful notion. You know, I can't, no doubts in the Buddha's teaching, but then doubts in myself. Can I do this? Can I actually do this? And if I think back myself, over 23 years since I came to the monastery, and had pretty strong renunciation when I came, but then the way it's actually played out, just so many mistakes. And fortunately, I'm still here. I'm still with it. But so many mistakes, so many times just losing the plot, so many times forgetting to be as respectful as I could to the teachers, or so many times where I just didn't keep the training standards as properly as I could have or should have. So there's, you know, there's so many mistakes that get made, but then there's also good things that have happened. So when I think when I would reveal all these mistakes to my own teachers, to Ajahn Amaro, Ajahn Pasano, especially early on, they'd constantly be pointing me toward, well, what about all the good things? Oh yeah, there was good things as well. There was a few times when I wasn't making mistakes. There was a few times when it seemed to come together. There was that full alignment of the practice. But yeah, it's easy for the mind to stick to those mistakes. But then it's always helpful to be reminded of these original aspirations and come back to them. We can actually come back to them at any time. Just like we can come back to awareness at any time. The awareness in the background is, again, it's never not there. The factor of mindfulness or remembrance of what is wholesome and unwholesome, what to be cultivating and what to be abandoning, that might not always be present, but that awareness is always there. So the mindfulness is what reminds us of it. Sati just means the act of remembrance, and sampajanya is the act of being with the awareness. So perhaps let's come back to also recollecting impermanence, because this is really, really crucial. If we do have any inkling or any desire to develop that strong sense of renunciation, like the great masters of the past who've come before us in all traditions, then we do have to recollect the fleeting nature of this life. And it's said it passes like a bubble, like a lightning bolt, like dew evaporating in the morning. It passes like a passing mist. And when we're in this life, then, and we're experiencing it, and we're going through our daily life, and we're trying to make ends meet, and so on, it can seem like things are lasting. And then before we know it, it passes. So what happened? Before we know it, so we're young, and then before we know it, our youth is gone. We're middle-aged, and then before we know it, our middle age is gone, and we're older. You know, what happened? Where did it go? And then we're here now in this experience. So what a shame if we don't see this. What a shame if we just spend our lives committing unwholesome actions and reaping the fruits of suffering and dissatisfaction. What a shame if we don't use this precious opportunity to cultivate the Dhamma, do the best things we can do for ourselves and others. What a shame if we don't use this precious opportunity to keep precepts and cultivate ourselves in as wholesome a way as possible by cultivating goodwill and compassion, a sense of rejoicing, a sense of equanimity, the Brahmaviharas. You know, what a shame if we don't do what we can to realize the Four Noble Truths with the short time that we're given. It's as if we have this one opportunity. So thinking like this can give us a sense of urgency. So finally, on my last day in Thailand, I was able to see and pay respects to Ajahn Sik, which, by the way, he passes on his greetings to the community and to everybody. And it was actually very inspiring and illustrative of this renunciation when he talked about how he was practicing over the Vasa at Wat Manam Noi, this very, very remote monastery in Kanchanaburi province. And you actually have to take a boat to get there, and it's just very, very remote. And he said the practice was to try to keep the mind even. So trying to keep the mind in the middle all the time and seeing how much could he do that. And for me, I was kind of experienced this sort of joy listening to him, and that's mudita, listening to him talk about his practice. He said, it's so difficult. I might think about something I like or something I don't like, and then trying to keep the mind in the middle. But then to keep the mind in the middle, you can't be forcing it. But there has to be that intention or there has to be that unremitting mindfulness to do that. So he was talking about even like seeing water or tree or earth, not trying to get caught in that differentiation, just staying with seeing. And the scene is just the scene. So the just sticking with seeing, listening to sounds, good sounds, bad sounds, but not differentiating between the two, and just being sticking with hearing. And then with thoughts, good ideas, bad ideas, or he even used the example of missing a bayagiri, thinking about people at a bayagiri, and then trying to come back to just, oh, that's just thinking. That's just cognizing. And then seeing the mind kind of popping out from that and going up, going down, and then using mindfulness to try to bring it back to the middle. It's quite a wonderful, inspiring Dhamma discussion. So we know people who are practicing well. We know people who are really cultivating the path in this way. And we can use that. We can say, well, maybe I can try to do that. Maybe I can try to do that during this coming winter retreat, or maybe I can try to do that in whatever way I'm going to be practicing over the next period of time. Can I keep my mind in the middle? Can it be so it's just in the seen, there's only the seen, in the heard, there's only the heard, in the cognized, there's only the cognized? So really it struck me that what Ajahn Sekh was talking about was that this bahya of the bark cloth sutta, where bahya is a wanderer who actually thinks he's an arhant, but then some devas come and tell him he's not, but that there is an arhant, and he's known as the Buddha, and he's in such and such a place, and so Bahia goes to him and finds the Buddha on Pindabat, and Bahia bows down to the Buddha on Pindabat and says, please, Lord, teach me the Dhamma. He says, Bahia, it is not the right time. I'm on alms round. And a second and a third time, he says, you know, impermanence can strike at any time. I believe this is your teaching. And please, you know, who knows how much time I have in this life? And so the Buddha says, well, okay. He gives him this short teaching. In the seen, there's only the seen. In the heard, there's only the heard. In the cognized, there's only the cognized. This bahya is the complete ending of suffering. When in the seen, there's only the seen, and so on. You will not be, it's something like, you will not be made of this, you will not be made of that, you will not be in this, you will not be in that, you will not be apart from this, you will not be apart from that. You know, just this is the ending of suffering. And he realizes arhantship on the spot. It's one of the few examples of somebody who's not a monk realizing arhantship. There's only a few that are like this. Also like the Buddha's father is another example where he realizes arhantship without ordaining. So then, sure enough, what Bahia was saying about impermanence comes true. He goes off, he's achieved arhantship, and then an insane cow gores him to death right afterwards. And so at the end of the alms round, the Buddha says, okay, monks, go and collect your kinsman. We're going to build a chetty for him. And they're like, what? What's he talking about? What's the Buddha talking about? They find him. He's been killed by this cow, and they bring him to a certain place, and they start to erect a monument for him, and they're asking the Buddha, what are we doing? Why are we doing this? And the Buddha says, well, he was my foremost disciple in quick wisdom and quick realization. So he's the fastest to get from no stage of awakening to full arhantship. So it's appropriate to build a chetty for an arhant. And so that's what they did. They built a chetty for Bahia of the bark cloth. And say it's a recollection of impermanence, and it can happen anytime. Near the end of the Bhutan trip, I actually, we were in this one town called Jakar, and it was a not quite as, they weren't doing quite as well as other places in Bhutan. The city was, there was some problem with the government, and the local government needed the city to, the city had a, somehow like had a 30-year lease in one area. And then they're like, okay, your lease is up. Now you have to destroy that city and rebuild it across the river. We're going to use this for something else. And so the people were somewhat uprooted from, and it's still in the process of kind of being destroyed and rebuilt on the other side of the river. So it's, it seemed to be a little bit poorer, a little less affluent than other parts of Bhutan. And it's the one day that I thought, well, I want to go at least, I want to go alms round at least once. And between the morning and say like 11 a.m., we were going to get a flight from this little tiny airport back to Paro to end our trip. We had driven east across Bhutan, and then we took a flight. We were going to take a flight from this place back. So I decided I was just walk to the airport because it wasn't that far. And it's maybe an hour and a half walk or something. And do it as an alms round because Ajahnachala and I were going to eat at the airport anyway. And thought, oh, yeah, I'm not expecting to get anything because, yeah, it's Bhutan. We're dressed very differently. Some people may not even know we're monks. They might not know what Theravada monks dress like. And we look quite a bit different than the local monks there. But nonetheless, just went alms round with my bowl, went across a bridge, went to an area. And then at one point, I there was a large cow, and it kind of started coming near me. And I didn't know what it was doing, and it didn't have horns. And so I thought, oh, that's kind of a nice cow. And I kind of patted it on the head, and it jolted its head, and it like threw me like kind of into the street, and I landed on my feet. But it's definitely unexpected. And then I thought, right after that, I thought of this bahia, the bark cloth, that, oh, you know, be careful of those cows, you know, don't approach them like that. Yes. So, and maybe my metta barami wasn't quite perfected, so it got irritated by me. And so then I continued the alms round, and then I went into this one area and started kind of going up a hill. And then this like dog just attacked me, was trying to bite me and lunging at me. And I had to kick it away. And I just kind of turned around quickly and went back the other direction. Okay, don't go up there. I was wondering what was going on with that. And then didn't receive any food from local people, but a lot of local people were taking pictures of me and videotaping me. So maybe they'll do some research and figure out what a monk on alms round is doing. But I did get offerings from our group. So we had a group of, there was the two of us monks and then 16 lay people. So some of the lay people were also walking to the airport rather than taking the bus. And did get some offerings from them, which was nice. So in Bhutan, on the one alms round that I went on, I only got offerings from Americans, but not from the local people. And they don't really have that tradition there. It's more that the monks stay in the monasteries and things are cooked there. Lay people might support them with their crops. They might give part of their crop to the monastery. But there's no alms round tradition, so it's just the form that Buddhism has taken there. So yeah, just good to be reminded of these ideas of renunciation and impermanence and doing what we can to do what's good to cultivate parami. And so we do have this precious opportunity now in the monastery, and just to make the best of it, make the most of it. So I think that's enough. That's appropriate for the time allotted this evening. I'll leave it there.